Hello, thank you for calling Podcast Phone. For Barely Podcasting, press 1.
Hi, this is Barely from Barely Podcasting Podcast.
Congratulations, you have selected the Barely Podcasting Podcast. The Barely Podcasting Podcast is barely funny.
Blah, blah, blah.
Barely provocative.
Blah, blah, blah.
And barely spontaneous.
So that's what I've been doing at work, trying to match my voice to the sound of the drills and the pressure things and all the gadgets and gadgets.
What? Oh, sorry. Sometimes funny, sometimes provocative. Oh, my bad. The Barely Podcasting Podcast is
sometimes funny. Sometimes provocative.
I like being without any clothes on, first of all.
But don't take my word for it.
Kilroy 2.0 is here. Kilroy 2.0 is everywhere. The prophet commands that you listen to the entire episode of Barely Podcasting. Do you comply?
And now, your host who's barely just arrived, Barely!
Hey everybody, it's time for another web-only exclusive! Well, no, not really an exclusive. You've heard all of this. Which is why I am putting this web only. I debated, and I do have a surprise for you next week, folks, in the regular feed. But I figured I would still put this out. I did promise it. So, hey, here is my whole interview with J.C. Hutchins, author of Seventh Son. I'm with J.C. Hutchins, and... First of all, JC, I have to say you're the first person I've ever interviewed on my show.
Oh, my God. You're kidding.
The only other people that are ever on are people calling in saying they're adorkable.
And what a great catchphrase. I read that and I just went nuts. I thought, well, you know, and of course, you know, I'm always all about, coining new phrases. What was it? The other day I was driving and I called a fellow driver who cut me off a fool biscuit. And I really like the sound of that, fool biscuit. So now everyone who does me wrong is a fool biscuit. So I love inventing words and I love slang like that. So when I heard adorkable, I'm like, oh, why didn't I think of that? You better get that domain name before I steal it from you.
Oh, well, okay. Yeah, I'm. Let's pause right now and I'm going over to GoDaddy.
but no, it is. Big fan of your podcast, and you're such a great storyteller. So it's a pleasure to be here, and I have a really strong feeling that despite the fact that this may be your first interview, you're going to knock it out of the ballpark.
Oh, I appreciate that, namely coming from the guy who created your first new word, the cliffhanger.
Yes, oh
I
my
was
God.
In. You I were... can see exactly where I was when I did that too, because I was ticked. I was livid when you just stopped, and I'm like.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, and I know that many of your listeners may know about Seventh Son, but for those who haven't listened, you know, one of the great things about, at least for me, and it seems to be for the listeners, one of the great things about the story is that it's a thriller, and that it works very well to end a chapter on a lot of unresolved plot, you know, threads to keep you turning the pages when you're reading a book. And in the instance of Seventh Son, you have to wait a week for the next episode. And Barry brilliantly coined not only adorkable, but cliffhangered as a verb. And that's the feeling that you get when you hit the end of a Seventh Son episode and the author, that terrible man, J.C. Hutchins, leaves you hanging on a cliff and unresolved until the following week, cliffhangered. It's a hit. It's viral. People use it now in email and in voicemails, instant messages that I receive. I mean, it's a part of the Seventh Son experience now, Barry.
Well, it's not even just part of the Seventh Son experience. I've been seeing it in other podcasts.
Mm-mm.
Like, oh, that's no. My word.
No, no. Tell me more. Tell me more. No, this is great.
I think I heard it once in a Sigler
in Scott Sigler's Rookie, where someone came up and said, "You've cliffhangered us."
Oh, sweet.
And I was just like, oh, Hutch has to be just going out of his mind right now.
Oh, not well. You know, the great thing, you know, one of the many things that I've kind of learned about storytelling and you know, catchphrases and whatnot is that once you set, I mean, you ownership is a difficult kind of thing, and the smaller of an ego that you have about that sort of thing, and the once it gets out into the wild, I mean, it kind of becomes it has its own life. I certainly think that about Seventh Son, the podcast novel I've created, because I mean, you know, it is kind of, it has a life of its own. And so with in the instance of hearing cliffhangered on a podcast or in feedback about something other than Seventh Son, that's just amazing to me. I mean, that tickles me. I'm not upset about it at all. In fact, I'm doing the Snoopy dance. That's fantastic.
Oh, I tried to do the Snoopy dance. I listen to all my podcasts while I'm driving.
Uh-huh.
And it's really hard to do the Snoopy dance when you have one foot on the gas, one foot on the brake, and you're in rush hour traffic. You begin to kind of move the feet, and all of a sudden you're like, oh, car ahead of me.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because, I'm a big fan of audio fiction myself, and listening to other podcasts. I mean, you know, there I am, literally. It's like literally the edge of the seat. Well, how did I scoot up so far here at the office chair?
Yeah, I've been pulled back by my seatbelt more than once listening to both you and to Scott Sigler.
Right. And well, yeah.
Both of you. But I do have to say, you are definitely the master when it comes to being cliffhanger.
Well, thank you. And it's certainly a great company to be in with Scott Sigler. And more than anything else, it's, you know, I just get so tickled when I hear that again, because that means that the story's doing the job that I wanted it to do. And that's really kind of cool, is to know that the intent of the work is actually, you know, being executed successfully by getting this kind of feedback, and literally, you know, people saying, you know, in a feedback voicemail line calls, you know, damn you for doing this. And it's like, okay, so I'm going to roast in hell. This is good. I'm happy with that.
And that's always a unique experience, I guess you could say, to be yelled at by people who want more.
Yes. I hate you. I love you. You know, that whole thing.
You begin to wonder if all your listeners are bipolar.
Or apparently I'm playing them like a piano, and they love every minute of it, you know, so I'm thrilled. Yeah. It's been a very flattering year and a half. I mean, it really has.
Oh, I can totally imagine. I mean, you've just exploded across the podosphere, doing new things that no one has really ever thought about doing. The book launch for your second book, Deceit. Yeah, Descent, Deceit, yeah.
it's hard to keep track, I know.
But when you did your the book launch for Deceit in Second Life.
Right.
No one had ever thought about doing that.
No, I know. And as far as I know, and I mean, I say this with a lot of certainty, I'd say around, you know, in the high 90s certainty, that no other novelist either in podcast or in print had done that before. So, I mean, while we, you know, the J.C. Hutchins and Seventh Son Book 2's debut will never be marked down in any kind of, you know, history about, you know, how to market your novel in Second Life, we'll all kind of know that it started somewhere. And as far as I know, I was the first to do it. So it's really cool to kind of be a part of that. And we had so much fun that night.
Oh, yeah, I was there. I remember after the book was done, all of a sudden you're doing a couple interviews with the Kimi.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, it was like things were exploding around you. I mean, there was kind of a scream come in, and then all of a sudden you'd hear an explosion, and there was just fire around you. I was like, this? I can't imagine anyone else getting this kind of reaction.
Well, you got to understand something that so many that, you know, I'm a schlubby white guy with glasses, a self-proclaimed geek. I mean, I'm not, there's nothing really, I don't really perceive myself as being special in any way. And then, and never have been, quite the contrary, being kind of dorky and not being popular at all. And going into Second Life, and being able to type, you know, in the little instant message system that they have there, you know, like, do you comply? And then, you know, 60, 70 people instant messaging back and their little avatars clapping, saying, "We comply, we comply." It was like Cleveland, are you ready to rock? Like, I was like, it was a total ego trip. It was amazing.
No, it looked like you were having so much. Of course, how can I tell from like your avatar?
Yeah, I know, but you know, yeah, but I mean, you know, where the avatar isn't very expressive. You know, I tried to make up with that either in the audio Q&A that the Kimi, Gary, and Itazura Radio did, kind of kicking off the event, and then in making sure that I, you know, interacted with as many people as I could while I was there. I mean, I wanted to make sure that people knew just how excited I was to be there.
Yeah, it was such an experience, and it is still cool that the Seven Sun facility is still available on Podcast Island.
Yeah, I was really, I've been really surprised by that. I don't know how well it's trafficked, and to be completely honest, I mean, here's you know where I feel a little hypocritical. I had hoped to spend much more time in Second Life after the debut party for Book Two, and this as the podcast has, you know, as Seven Sun has kind of really, really increased in popularity, it has taken me away from not only being able to do things in Second Life, but being able to do things in real life. I mean, it's just it's become a second full-time job. So I haven't been able to go in there, but I'm so surprised that it's still there, and that I do get feedback from listeners every once in a while who visit there and are able to, you know, find and obtain the cool little clone avatars. You can change the appearance of your avatar to become one of the characters in Seventh Son. I mean, that's just amazing, and I'm glad that Gary and the gang have kept it there.
Yeah. Actually, my avatar, because I'd been hunting for one, that just it never fit until I found John.
Mm-hmm.
Not John Alpha, but just John.
Right. Yeah.
And I have kept that. I think the only thing I've changed on him has been his shirt.
Yeah.
I have either a Seventh Son shirt or a Chicago Bears shirt.
Oh, that's a hell of a company to be in, brother. it's either my work or the Chicago Bears. Hell yeah, I'm there. That's great. Thank you. And they really were masterfully created avatars. And, you know, one of the really, really cool things was that when Itazura Radio, who has basically, I mean, pixel by pixel built that podcast island for the community, he and I were in pretty close talks about, you know, what they would look like. And, you know, I was providing, physical descriptions. And despite the fact that the Second Life graphics engine isn't Pixar, you know, it's not mm-hmm. the highest quality, 3D graphics rendering, blah blah blah. I don't know the language, but I was, when I opened up that JPEG for the first time to see the avatars, I was just so, I was like, he nailed it. He freaking nailed these guys. It was uncanny.
Yeah, everything that was done for that launch, going up and seeing the facility, each one of the individuals. I was each one of the clones, actually. Mm. I was just blown away because that's exactly what I saw in my mind from your description.
Yeah. You know, we've done a really good job of of kind of realizing without being able to build anything in real life, there have been some exceptional realizations of the Seventh Sun set pieces in Second Life and in the virtual world, not only with Itazura's work, but there's a listener named Martin Parrott who has created a kind of like a tour, like an interactive virtual tour of this Seventh Sun facility, the super secret facility where a lot of the action in the first novel takes place, and he and I were working very, very closely to make sure that tour, that experience, was as close to what I had in my mind as possible. And what's really cool is, you know, you go to my homepage, you click the link, you go into this experience, and it's not just that. You're looking at photographs, but you can tilt the camera and zoom in and zoom out and then like click a door and then you're sent into the next room beside it. I mean, it was just, it's so cool. And so again, it's like, I just keep coming back to the word flattering. It is so flattering to know that people are willing to dedicate their, you know, their creative energies to, for no money. I mean, nobody's getting paid to do this stuff. Just to kind of be a part of that experience and to share their work with other listeners and with me, it's humbling.
Yeah, it really has been. I've been following you. I think I came on, I wasn't one of your first listeners, and I have to apologize on that one.
It's free. Don't worry. It's not like you got it for a discount later. I'm just happy you're listening.
But I came in, I think it was like 6 or 7 episodes in.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been there from early on.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And just listening to the whole thing and then just how it exploded. I mean, at first it was just kind of like, I'm like, okay, well, yeah, that's like me. Just sitting in front of a microphone, maybe someone's listening, maybe someone's not.
Right, right.
And then all of a sudden hearing what everybody was doing, and I've been checking out the website. It's actually one of on my banner, whatever, on my home pages.
Oh, right, sure, sure, excellent.
I have a link to you because I've reviewed Seventh Son on my show.
Yes, yes, you sure did, bless your heart. And you are, and Barry, that is why you are going to heaven.
I'm going to heaven because you're going to hell because I'm making more people damn you there.
That's fine. Yeah, there's some kind of karmic thing going on there. I'm happy with it, but yeah, I mean, because of the awesome review, of course, it's at your gateway. As long as you don't kill any children or kittens, you're good for the rest of your life.
Oh, okay. I'll take that.
but anyway, you were saying, yeah.
On my browser, I have a bunch of links of sites I regularly check. Mm. And yours is one of them, and I just hop in there, and I'm just blown away on what your listeners have done for you.
Yeah, no one is more surprised than me. The thing is that I do my very best to never take this kind of thing for granted, and that none of it feels passé or predictable when I receive like, I mean, I just the other day I received another, you know, photograph of someone in a Betaclone shirt. I mean, you just kind of stop and you think to yourself, you know, the story has inspired, you know, the story and the community that has kind of grown around the story has been elevated to a point where people are willing to buy a shirt that represents your heart, you know, in a way represents and advertises your hard work, and then photographs it and sends it to you so you can, you know, make them a part of, you know, this Betaclone army army of photographs that I've got on my site. I mean, where it's like, you know, not being afraid to buy that shirt, not being afraid to photograph yourself, to go through the effort of photographing yourself and then sharing it with the world. I mean, you know, that's really cool, and that's just one example of just, I mean, dozens of items of content that listeners have created, music and, I mean, a poem. I couldn't believe it. I got a Seventh Son poem. It was amazing, and fan fiction, and I mean, seriously, like literary essays, kind of based on the philosophies and theology that's kind of discussed and spirituality that's discussed in Seventh Son. I mean, it kind of runs the gamut from the silly to the intellectual, and I'm all for all of that. So I mean the inbox overfloweth. Trust me.
Well, let's go back to when you first got the idea for Seventh Son.
Mm-hmm.
How long did it take for you to come up with it until you felt it was ready for either publication or putting it out as a podcast? I mean, how long was that duration?
It's been a really long – this thing has been a really long time in the making. And, you know, when I start to think about it, it's a very, very long journey that I didn't expect to take so long. but I, you know, I also don't think that it could have – I don't think that it's been the perfect storm. I don't think that it could be done any other way. I wouldn't want it to have happened any other way in hindsight. But in 2001, you know, I conceived this idea for a comic book, and it involved seven human clones who had, you know, in this fictional universe, human memories could be recorded and downloaded into brains. You know, so you got to kind of, you know, got to. Or leap, make the leap of faith there with me there. Excuse me. Hang on a second. You got to make the leap of faith with me on that. I mean, that was one of the things that I knew was a part of the core technology, because one of the things that, and this is kind of an aside, pardon me, but, you know, I love evil twin stories. I love clone stories. Ever since I was a kid, I've always wanted a twin. Ever since I was a kid, I have been fascinated with duality and twins and clones. But so many times in fiction, when one clones the body, somehow memories come with it. You know, so that the clone has the same memories. But we know that, you know, you can't clone a soul scientifically. You can't clone a human memory scientifically. You can only clone tissue. And so one of the things that I wanted to do was kind of separate the biological cloning from a kind of intellectual or emotional cloning where – and I wanted to cover that base by having – you know, the ability to record human memories. Okay, that's my aside. So you know, clones. I wanted clones. I wanted a human memory recording, and and each clone had a different expertise, and they all had superpowers. So one was strong, and one was smart, and one was, you know, one could fly and all that stuff. Well, I realized that in the end, while I liked the core idea of that, I didn't want to write a comic book. I wanted to write a novel. And there it sat, this core idea of clones, memory recording, taking on a villain, and then the idea of, well, who's the villain? Well, it has to be the guy that they were cloned from, and that's just too good to pass up. You got to have their kind of genetic progenitor be the villain and whatnot. And then I sat on it for about a year and a half. And finally, about a year or so. That was, I guess, 2001. And by 2002, I was writing it. And it took me until 2004 to write the entire manuscript, which we now know as books 1, 2, and 3. I mean, right. I chopped them up for the podcast and hopefully for eventual mainstream publication. Anyway, so it took me about 2 years to write it and then a few months to edit it and chop out some flab. And then a year was spent trying to send it to literary agents to represent the novel and taking them to publishers for publication. It went nowhere. And so by the end of 2005, I was, you know, I knew some things. I knew that my book didn't have a future, and at least in the traditional in the form in which I had written it, this 1,100-page manuscript. And I also knew that I was completely bitten by the podcasting bug and was smitten by the works of, you know, Scott Sigler, T. Morris, Mark Jeffrey, Matt Selznick, Jack Mangan. You know, Podiobooks.com had launched in October of 2005. I mean, it was like things were just kind of coalescing, and by early 2006, I had decided that, you know, this is what I'm going to do. If I can't sell it, I'll share it. And that's when I decided to release it as a podcast. And the first episodes went live for Book One, Descent, in late February. Late February. So that's when it was out in the wild in 2006.
Okay. So we've been roughly around the same amount of time.
Yeah, podcasting. Yes.
Yeah, podcast. Sorry.
Oh, no. Yeah, I'm just, yeah. I mean, unless you'd been thinking about your podcast back in 2001, then.
No.
I had this idea, but.
Well, I did. I am a disgruntled DJ, I guess you can say. Mm-hmm. I did it in high school, but, I mean, that was literally spinning records in 8 tracks.
Right on, man. Right on.
In my high school.
Analog, baby. I love it.
Oh, boy. I could just tell you, compared to what I'm working with in my home, yeah. My high school had a pathetic studio.
Oh, well. You know, but hey, I mean, you know, but I'm sure that there have been, you know, that life experience in some way, you know, has helped, you know, translate into or prepare you for what you're doing now with the podcast.
Oh, absolutely, because my degree is in I have two. I have one in criminal justice and then one in audio-video production.
Oh, fantastic. Right.
So, and I'm not doing too much with either of them in my current career. So when this came along, I was like, ooh, this, perfect. I need this. I need for my creative juices to be able to come out.
Right.
And I think that's what a lot of podcasters have come out with. It's more of a creative outlet for them.
Yeah, you know, it's a very democratic way of getting the work out. I mean, minimal investment up front, super minimal maintaining investment of, you know, like paying a website to host your files or whatever, or your website. And, you know, and what do you get in return? Well, you know, if you're creating you know, an outlet for your voice that that gains a large audience, well, then it's very rewarding indeed, because then there's the viral nature of it, and oh my God, have you heard this show, or blah blah blah, and people start gravitating toward it. And even if it's not, you know, a success in the way we seem to measure success in podcasting, which is by audience numbers, it's a success because you're saying whatever the hell you want to. You're expressing yourself. You're getting. You may even get, you know, experimental with storytelling or whatever. And it feeds the creative beast. I mean, you know, I think that we all need an outlet. Whether you're like a chair maker on the side. I mean, you just make furniture in your garage for fun, or you're a writer or an artist, or, you know, a break dancer. It doesn't matter, as long as you've got something to kind of, you know, to keep you sane. I mean, I really think that that being creative and having an outlet is a key to having a very, you know, healthy, not only have a healthy, you know, self-expression, but just have a healthy life.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've seen that a lot with friends and family too. They have their creative outlets.
Mm-hmm.
And this one's mine, because
yeah,
honestly, I can't draw a straight line.
Nor can I. So I'm with you. You know, but you know, and I think that that's the key, is to kind of understand that, you know, I don't think that anybody is going to get rich anytime soon off of podcasting, but you know, you're not going to get rich off of, you know, drawing sketches at home either. It's just a way to kind of funnel either your frustrations, or just kind of clear the mental palate and expose yourself to the, you know, to the world in whatever medium you choose to do it. I mean, it's important to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, getting back to Seventh Son, I've wanted to know, because I know there's one character in which I would want to be, mm-hmm. but out of your clones, the seven of them, assuming they're all still alive, and fortunately you haven't killed off the one that I want to be. Came awfully close, but
right.
I think he's looking up right now in an Aurora landing.
Yes, 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 indeed. Bless his heart. Well, you know, yeah, the seven clones, and again, for listeners, I'm just going to kind of go down the list here for listeners who haven't listened to Seventh Son yet. You know, Seventh Son, seven clones, they're the good guys in this story. They were unwitting participants in a human cloning experiment. They never knew that they were clones, and that they had shared memories, until the guy that they were cloned from masterminded the assassination of the president. And he's out on the loose, and he's got bad things in store for the world. And that's when the creators of this science project bring the clones together. They come out of hiding, bring the clones together, and kind of tell them, you know, that they need to help stop the villain. Okay, so the seven clones are, let's see, there's John, who is kind of your everyman, college dropout. He's a guitarist, bartender, and carpenter. He's a nice emotional anchor for the story in many ways. There is Jack, the geneticist. He's a family man. He's got twin daughters, and he's a scientist. There's Jonathan, who seems to be kind of in many ways the cowardly lion of the bunch. He works for the UN. He's cynical and a little cowardly. He's often he often plays the naysayer role in discussions with the other clones. But you need to have that. You need to have someone kind of questioning things, and he does a really good job of that. There's Dr.
But yet, interrupt you here, but Jonathan, I think, got the envy of all of the clones.
And isn't that ironic? That's right. because in the clones have shared memories from birth to the age of 14, okay? And they all share the memories of their genetic and intellectual progenitor, John Alpha, the villain. And John Alpha, in high school, you know, met a wonderful young girl, also in high school, named Patricia Ross, and they had their first kiss, and they were quite smitten with each other. And then, because of the timetable of the experiment, the genetics experiment, John Alpha was ripped away from that life, being with Patricia Ross. And years later, we find out that Jonathan, one of the seven clones, has married Patricia Ross. So despite the fact that he seems to be kind of like the wimp of the bunch, he's also the luckiest, because, you know, he got the girl, you know, he got the girl that they all wanted to have.
Yeah, and I think in all of our lives, there's a time that we can kind of go back. It's like, I wish I could have done that or gotten that. And he did it for all of them.
He did. And what's interesting about, you know, what the clones have been kind of sent off, you know, the clones have very different areas of expertise, and they have very different adult attitudes because of the lives that they've lived. And that's kind of one of the subtexts of Seventh Son is that, you know, what if I had, you know, I was thinking about this the other day. It's like I failed chemistry in high school, second semester in high school, in that junior year, and I had to take it. You know, I had to retake that second semester senior year. What if I had passed it? What if I had gotten on fire for chemistry? What would have happened to my life? You know, that sort of thing. And we see the kind of what if, you know, extrapolated for these seven guys. Jonathan being one of them. So there's Jonathan. I think that's number four. Dr. Mike is he's an asshole. He's a criminal profiler. He lives in Los Angeles. Very full of himself. Very talented at what he does. But he's kind of the he often rubs people the wrong way and is very opinionated. There is Father Thomas, who is a Catholic priest who lives in Oklahoma. Very, very spiritual, and he has a crisis of faith when he discovers that he's a clone. You know, he wonders, you know, it's not that he stopped believing in God. It's that now that he's a clone, he wonders if God ever believed in him, if he has a soul. So that's a story for that's something that he has to deal with. There is Michael the Marine, and he's your no-nonsense U.S. Marine Corps guy, tough as nails, takes no crap from anybody, and is the natural leader of the group. And then finally, there's Kilroy 2.0, the apparently quite insane computer hacker who has a messiah complex and, you know, has a flock of followers out there who seem to not only listen to what he says but does whatever he says. And so he's been the breakout hit of the novel for fans. Kilroy, of the seven, I mean, who would I like to be the most? Mm-hmm. Boy. Well, you know, I think in the end it would be John, mostly because John, up until the events of his of Seventh Son, was living a fairly anonymous life. You know, he's got a girlfriend, he's got a cat, he you know, he's pursuing this dream of being a professional musician, but you know, it's not really going anywhere, but he seems to be okay with that. But what's interesting is that when he discovers that he's a clone, I mean, his mind is rocked from that, make no mistake. But as events start to unfold in the book, he begins to take a more a higher position in leadership, and he kind of comes into his own as, you know, being the blue collar everyman to being the natural leader of the group. And I think that not only John represents kind of like my sensibilities from a, you know, creative and kind of almost life perspective way, where, you know, John's mantra is basically live and let live, and that's pretty much mine, you know, but I also dream of one day being kind of like John is in the book, where he, you know, assumes more control over his destiny and you know, brings people with him and is, you know, becomes confident in himself. And I think that so many people identify with that.
Yeah, and he was also, just to give the readers a little bit of a history, out of the seven clones, he was the first one introduced.
Yes, yes.
And I know when I was listening to the book, I thought it was going to be more about John.
Right.
Just kind of going through, since you had the introduction really with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure if that's true of everyone who listened or everyone who reads a book, but the first good guy you find, is that really the one that you follow or not? And I'm not sure. I don't know if there's really an answer to that one.
Well, you know, and one of the things that was kind of it was a creative decision. It was a deliberate decision to start the story with John, and you know, and yes, while we spend some time in the other clones' minds or the other heroes' minds throughout much of book one, nearly all of it is kind of told from, you know, his perspective. But as you know, the events of the outside world and the scheme of John Alpha start to kind of truly encroach on their lives, where, they have to kind of get over the fact that they're clones, and they have to get over the fact that they have to work together, and then start to kind of get into the meat and the plot of the story. That's when the camera kind of pulls away from John and almost becomes omniscient in a way where we are, you know, where it, the camera's just kind of like out of his head, and it becomes more of about the group and what the group is thinking and how they're going to handle it. We do go back into John's mind in various spots, but we also, you know, jump into other clones' heads as well as the story progresses. And the idea mostly there was to make sure that the plot kept on going. And once, you know, I wanted John to be the anchor, the point of view character, right? But the further we went in the story, I wanted it to be more about the group. And, you know, I certainly haven't heard any detractors for that great creative decision, but I also haven't heard anybody, you know, clap me on the back about it either. It's just kind of the way it is. I'm kind of curious to know how people, you know, now that I've kind of illuminated that, how people might react to that.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm trying to think of it from my perspective. And God knows I'm not a writer. I guess I'm a disgruntled one. Having a audio-video production background, mm-hmm. I had to take a script writing class, and I started a movie script.
Yes.
And I started off with one line that really kind of pushed me forward, and then I started writing this whole thing. I got up to a point, and I just got writer's block.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So I'm like, okay, let me try to take everything I have in my mind and put it into a novel. Got up to the same point, writer's block.
Right, right.
And I just sat there, and I've been sitting on this for, I think, 3 years.
I think that if anything, I mean, there's a couple ways to kind of, you know, you shake the rust off of those spurs, and one of them is just to start, you know, is just to do it and just be mm-hmm. like, I don't care if I don't know how it's going to – I don't care if that I don't know where it's going. I just got to, you know, push my forehead through this wall that I've been banging it against and just, you know, and become a wrecking ball and just frickin' do it. Another thing is, and I'm convinced of this, is that sometimes stories just take time. You know, Seventh Son, I sat on it for about a year before I started writing it, mostly because I had to kind of get the gumption to do it. I mean, it's an act of courage, you know, expressing yourself artistically in whatever way. Because it requires a kind of honesty with yourself and, you know, and being willing to listen to the voice within and being able to kind of channel that onto the screen or onto the canvas or the, you know, the music or whatever you're, you know, whatever artistic endeavor you're going to do. So, you know, I mean, my thought on it is that either just sit down and, you know, time to become a wrecking ball and bang down the door, or understand that, you know, maybe it's just percolating. Maybe it's just simmering, and that when it comes, it comes. It sounds a little metaphysical, but, you know, that's kind of how I see it. I mean, it's kind of spooky, this writing thing.
Yeah, yeah, and I have so much respect for writers who can actually just pump things out.
Yeah, so do I. Because Seventh Son came in Herks and Jerks. I mean, it's not like I sat down and, you know, and just wrote every day and wrote 5,000 words every day, and then at the end I looked up and had a, you know, perfect novel. I mean, not only were there holes in the manuscript where I knew I had to go back and, you know, finesse things and edit things in, but also, I mean, it's like I would put the – I mean, I remember for you, Barry, since you've listened to book one, you know that, you know, there's a sequence where some of our heroes go to Los Angeles, and they mm-hmm. you know get in a van and they drive to the what appears to be the secret hideout of the villain, and they're waiting in the van and they're about to break into the lair, and I put down the I didn't know where to go, and I put it down for 3 months. So I mean, you know, it's just like it just wasn't. I just had no idea what to do with it, and then it was Hutchins. You just got to frickin' do it. You know, and that's what I did, because I discovered that I was more unhappy not writing than I was writing but not knowing where I was going. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I had those feelings where I'm like, I want to finish this, but so what I've done is I went through and jumped ahead about 10 chapters to one scene, and it's not a sci-fi book or anything. It's actually about professional bicycle racing.
Cool. Right.
Tour de France. Actually, the big climactic scene is in the Tour de France.
Nice.
And I have them. The whole chapter is pretty much climbing a hill and coming down. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's the whole thing. But it all of a sudden it hit my head, and I'm like, ooh. And I just started going. So I've kind of almost finished the whole book. or from that point forward.
Right, right.
But I have the middle on how do you go from point A to point C.
Right, and it's so hard to do that. I mean, for me, what I would do is, you know, we talked earlier in this, you know, this chat about being cliffhangered and how you know, it's so frustrating and yet so thrilling for the audience to be cliffhangered. Well, it was frustrating and thrilling for me because what I would do is, you know, I would sit down and again, it's like I had an eventually the longer I was telling the story, the more I had a better idea of what the ending was going to be and where I would like all that to go down. But I had to get there. And so what I would do is, I would stop writing once I got to a certain point. And I would plot out the next five chapters. I would literally write at the top of the page, what happens next? It was just like it became my mantra. What happens next? What happens next? Come on, Hutchins. What happens next? And then I would plot about five chapters worth of ideas. It killed the ones that I didn't like. And then then it was like, okay, so here's this kind of loosey goosey skeleton of where I'd like to go. And of course, at the end of this plotting, I would have a very big unresolved plot, plot thread. So even I was cliffhangering myself. and the thing was is that, that seems kind of counterintuitive, but for someone like me, it was, okay, I have put them in the worst possible situation and I don't know how they're going to get out of it. But boy, I mean, I'm really dying to find out. But the only way to earn the right to find out is to write these five chapters that I just plotted, that sort of thing. So it was almost like, a leapfrog in that way, just baby steps towards it. Maybe, maybe that'll help. Just what happens next?
Yeah, since I've started listening to you, I've been more and more inclined to go back to this project.
Awesome,
that I have.
Awesome, awesome. Well, you see, it's something to think about it. And it's certainly I'm not one of those folks who evangelizes for, do it, damn it. I mean, no. I mean, like the harder you push someone who isn't ready to do something, the harder they're going to push back. So I'm real, I'm real diplomatic about encouraging writing. I never say do it. I say, look, it's something to think about. And the fact that here's the flattering thing is that you're not the first person who's told me that my writing and my podcast has inspired them to, start thinking about, telling stories again in prose or whatever. And I mean, that just blows me away. And it's kind of hard to wrap your brain around the fact when someone says, you're inspiring me. I mean, that's just that's the ultimate compliment. That's worth $1,000. That's worth $1,000 because that means that the work is kind of hitting someone in a way that is invaluable and is intangible and motivating them. And that's beyond price. And so I'm really. Yeah, I'm amazed to hear that. And all I can say is that, hey, look, I mean, what do you have to lose? I mean, it's not like you have to show anybody what you're writing, and it's not like you have to print it out and, give it to the Library of Congress. Nothing like that at all. It's just something to noodle on and think about. And like I said, I mean, the whole concept for people who are stuck, and I know this from experience, the mantra, what happens next, became so important to me because in the end, Barry, I knew what was going to happen next. I began to see what I knew in my heart of hearts what was going to happen next, but I didn't have the foresight to be able to express it tangibly, and so that's why it became so helpful for me.
Yeah, I think I'll start using that now from this point forward. Once I get back into writing it.
Well, sure. I have to give credit where credit is due. I mean, the idea of what happens next, those words literally came from a New York Times bestselling novelist named Brad Meltzer, who writes, I think he's a brilliant writer, and he writes fantastic legal and political thrillers. And I have the good fortune of knowing him quasi personally. I mean, like, we've spoken, met through, professional friends or whatever. And and I remember going to a book signing of his and kind of laying it out, much like you, Barry, where it's like, I'm in the second act. I think I know where all this is going to end, but I'm stuck. And that's when he turned to me and said, you know the answer to this question in your heart, but you have to keep asking it, what happens next? And as soon as I heard that, it became clear, and it changed my life, and it changed my work ethic.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing how just something so small can change everything.
And seemingly underwhelming, because the words, what happens next, that doesn't sound very profound.
No, it doesn't. But yet at the same time.
But yeah, give it a shot. Let's see. I mean, you know, it's free advice. I mean, you see what you can do with it.
Yeah, I mean, there's always that little quirky thing that just gets you moving. Mm-hmm. And what actually I did want to kind of ask you this one is when you sit down to record, mm-hmm. are there any quirky things you do? I mean, like Scott Sigler, I mean, we've mentioned him before. He goes into his closet.
Right.
And, I mean, I'm sitting in a basement for crying out mm-hmm, loud with the right. washing machine and the heater right behind me.
Right.
And my computer open. I mean, I can look into my computer because it overheats otherwise.
Right.
But, and then I always have to sit at, like, the edge of my chair. Otherwise, it squeaks.
It squeaks, yes.
And there's all these little quirky things little I rituals. Have to do before yeah. I start. Yeah. What do you have to do?
Well, let's see. Well, you know, I record in a spare bedroom here in our apartment, and it's kind of like our I'm not going to say library because that makes it sound like it's a really impressive collection of books. It's not. It's just, you know, a couple of $30 bookshelves stocked with, you know, paperbacks and, you know, and thrillers and whatnot. Comic books in my case. And that's really it. So it's pretty, a fairly innocuous surroundings. And before, like back in the day with book one, I would often, because I didn't know the characters, the characters are much more part of my life now, and I'm much more, I find it much easier to get into vocal character with them when I perform for the podcast these days. It wasn't always like that. And so there was a ritual at one time where I would, you know, walk around the apartment and kind of rehearse these voices. And in particular, I remember, inventing the voice for a corrupt oil baron named A.U. Rookman, who has mm-hmm. this wonderful, just kind of like screw the world attitude and screw the world voice. And I remember waving my arms and running around the house, you know, trying to find his voice and finally nailing it and then dashing into the room to record it. These days, I think because it's become a much more predictable routine for me. I am able to, you know, what are my rituals? Well, you know, I get a big tall mason glass of water, and that's one thing. And I swap out my comfy squeaky chair for the very uncomfortable metal folding chair that does not squeak. And I read my manuscript. I read the chapter that I'm gonna record. I read it once and then I just fire it up. And typically that's about it. But when we get to doing the character voices, and I'm really, really, despite the fact that I'm not an actor, I'm very proud that so many people have complimented me on my performance of the characters for Seventh Son, because they're all very different voices. When I get to a character dialogue for Jack, for instance, I will often have to kind of get into that character very quickly. And what I will do, I've assigned ritualistic phrases to say that aren't in the novel at all. They're just things that I say to kind of get me into character. Jack is the one that a voice that I often have trouble with. So I have to say, "I'm Jack. I'm curious." And as I say, "I'm curious," I raise my voice. And now mm-hmm. I can talk like Jack. Oh, da 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 da. And you know, while there isn't a whole lot of difference, let's face it, between my voice of J.C. Hutchins and Jack's voice, there is enough to so that you can kind of distinguish it. With Kilroy 2.0, who is he's an obese mad hacker. He demands a certain kind of attitude and a certain kind of presentation, and he's known for his chuckle. So what I'll do to get into character for Kilroy is I'll begin to chuckle, and then I can tremble my voice and shake my head back and forth to talk like Kilroy 2.0. And it requires that kind of leap into that spot in my mind. So now the kooky rituals are often kind of what I do during recording to get into character.
You've killed off several of the clones. I'm not going to say who because you have to listen to the story.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. But yeah, one of the things that I wanted to make clear, and I think this is influenced by Joss Whedon's work. I mean, you know, Buffy, Angel, Firefly. Mm-hmm. Is that in his comic book work, is that no one is ever safe in his stories, and that, you know, when things are at their most serene, you better watch out because that's when someone's going to get it. And I kind of carried that into Seventh Son, where I wanted to make sure that people knew by the middle of book two that you can't count on anybody surviving.
But then again, you also can't expect anyone to actually die.
To be dead because of the technology that's in the book, right? Where, you know, our villain in particular has been misusing technology that allows him to be able to record his consciousness, the entirety of his human memories, and to dump them into victims' minds so that he can actually live on in another body in a way and control that body with his psyche downloaded in the mind. So you know, that's one of the big problems that the clones faced in book two for such wonderful reasons. I mean, it's like one of my favorite plot twists of all is in book two. But particularly, you know, that's a problem they're going to have to solve in book three, where it's like, if you cannot identify the villain in any kind of obvious way, how do you take him down when he can be anyone or anywhere? And so, right, you know, there's this idea of nobody's safe. But nobody, but the villain may not. You could stomp on the cockroach, and here comes another one. You know, it's like, how many of him is out there? And that's something that we'll learn in book three.
Oh, that's good to know that's coming up, because I've been wondering that myself.
Yeah, well, it's kind of hard to keep track. I mean, it's like we have enough scenes in books one and two with the villains kind of doing the machinations of the villains, where they're, you know, they're twirling their mustaches and they're, you know, speaking, you know, they're sharing their plan, but they're not revealing everything to the listener. Those scenes were so hard to write because, you know, it's like, how can I give hints without blowing the plot twists? And we've gleaned enough information to know that there seems to be a small number of copies of the villain and a small number of copies of the assassin thug sidekick named Devlin. But not everybody's accounted for. So there's still some tricks up my sleeve for that.
Yeah, you've let out just enough that everyone I know that I've talked to and gotten to listen, they're all kind of sitting there going, okay, what the heck is going on? Why is this character in there? And I'm like, I don't know.
Right.
But it's three books.
We got to wait. And it's my sincerest hope that everybody enjoys the ending. Otherwise, I mean, it'll be like the biggest con in podcasting. unintentional con. I swear. I guess I'm just a lousy writer.
I thought it was going to be more about John.
Right.
Just kind of going through, since you had the introduction really with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure if that's true of everyone who listened or everyone who reads a book, but the first good guy you find, is that really the one that you follow or not? I'm not sure. I don't know if there's really an answer to that one.
Well, you know, and one of the things that was kind of it was a creative decision. It was a deliberate decision to start the story with John, and you know, and yes, while we spend some time in the other clones' minds or the other heroes' minds throughout much of book one, nearly all of it is kind of told from, you know, his perspective. But as you know, the events of the outside world and the scheme of John Alpha start to kind of truly encroach on their lives, where they have to kind of get over the fact that they're clones, and they have to get over the fact that they have to work together, and then start to kind of get into the meat and the plot of the story. That's when the camera kind of pulls away from John and almost becomes omniscient in a way, where we are, you know, where the camera's just kind of like out of his head, and it becomes more of about the group and what the group is thinking and how they're going to handle it. We do go back into John's mind in various spots, but we also, you know, jump into other clones' heads as well as the story progresses. And the idea mostly there was to make sure that the plot kept on going. And once, you know, I wanted John to be the anchor, the point of view character, right? But the further we went in the story, I wanted it to be more about the group. And, you know, I certainly haven't heard any detractors for that great creative decision, but I also haven't heard anybody, you know, clap me on the back about it either. It's just kind of the way it is. I'm kind of curious to know how people, you know, now that I've kind of illuminated that, how people might react to that.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm trying to think of it from my perspective. And God knows I'm not a writer. I guess I'm a disgruntled one. Having a audio-video production background, I had to take a script writing class, and I started a movie script.
Yes.
And I started off with one line that really kind of pushed me forward. And then I started writing this whole thing. I got up to a point, and I just got writer's block.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So I'm like, okay, let me try to take everything I have in my mind and put it into a novel. Got up to the same point, writer's block.
Right, right.
And I just sat there, and I've been sitting on this for, I think, 3 years.
I think that if anything, I mean, there's a couple ways to kind of, you know, you shake the rust off of those spurs, and one of them is just to start, you know, it's just to do it and just be mm-hmm. like, I don't care if I don't know how it's going to – I don't care if that I don't know where it's going. I just got to, you know, push my forehead through this wall that I've been banging it against and, just, you know, and become a wrecking ball and just frickin' do it. Another thing is, and I'm convinced of this, is that sometimes stories just take time. You know, Seven Son, I sat on it for about a year before I started writing it, mostly because I had to kind of get the gumption to do it. I mean, it's an act of courage, you know, expressing yourself artistically in whatever way. Because it requires a kind of honesty with yourself and you know, and being willing to listen to the voice within and being able to kind of channel that onto the screen or onto the canvas or the, you know, the music or whatever you're, you know, whatever artistic endeavor you're going to do. So, you know, I mean, my thought on it is that either just sit down and, you know, time to become a wrecking ball and bang down the door, or understand that, you know, maybe it's just percolating. Maybe it's just simmering and that when it comes, it comes. It sounds a little metaphysical, but, you know, that's kind of how I see it. I mean, it's kind of spooky, this writing thing.
Yeah, yeah, and I have so much respect for writers who can actually just pump things out.
Yeah, so do I. Because Seven Son came in Herks and Jerks. I mean, it's not like I sat down and, you know, and just wrote every day and wrote 5,000 words every day, and then at the end I looked up and had a, you know, perfect novel. I mean, not only were there holes in the manuscript where I knew I had to go back and, you know, finesse things and edit things in, but also, I mean, it's like I would put the – I mean, I remember for you, Barry, since you've listened to book one, you know that, you know, there's a sequence where some of our heroes go to Los Angeles, and they mm-hmm. you know get in a van and they drive to the what appears to be the secret hideout of the villain, and they're waiting in the van and they're about to break into the lair, and I put down I didn't know where to go, and I put it down for 3 months. So I mean, you know, it's just like it just wasn't. I just had no idea what to do with it, and then it was Hutchins. You just got to frickin' do it. You know, and that's what I did, because I discovered that I was more unhappy not writing than I was writing but not knowing where I was going. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I had those feelings where I'm like, I want to finish this, but so what I've done is I went through and jumped ahead about 10 chapters to one scene, and it's not a sci-fi book or anything. It's actually about professional bicycle racing.
Cool. Right.
Tour de France. Actually, the big climactic scene is in the Tour de France.
Nice.
And I have them. The whole chapter is pretty much climbing a hill and coming down.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's the whole thing. But it all of a sudden it hit my head, and I'm like, ooh. And I just started going. So I've kind of almost finished the whole book, or from that point forward.
Right, right.
But I have the middle on how do you go from point A to point C.
Right, and it's so hard to do that. I mean, for me, what I would do is, you know, we talked earlier in this, you know, this chat about being cliffhangered and how you know, it's so frustrating and yet so thrilling for the audience to be cliffhangered. Well, it was frustrating and thrilling for me, because what I would do is, you know, I would sit down and again, it's like I had an eventually the longer I was telling the story, the more I had a better idea of what the ending was going to be and where I would like all that to go down. But I had to get there. And so what I would do is, you know, I would stop writing once I got to a certain point. And I would plot out the next 5 chapters. I would literally write at the top of the page, what happens next? It was just like it became my mantra. What happens next? What happens next? Come on, Hutchins. What happens next? And then I would plot about you know, 5 chapters worth of ideas. Kill the ones that I didn't like, and then I mean, and then it was like, okay, so here's this kind of loosey goosey skeleton of where I'd like to go. And of course, at the end of this plotting, I would have a very big unresolved plot, you know, plot thread. So even I was cliffhangering myself.
And the thing was, is that, you know, and that seems kind of counterintuitive, but for someone like me, it was, okay, I have put them in the worst possible situation and I don't know how they're going to get out of it. But boy, I mean, I'm really dying to find out. But the only way to earn the right to find out is to write these five chapters that I just plotted, you know, that sort of thing. So it was almost like, a leapfrog in that way, just baby steps towards it. Maybe, mm-hmm. Maybe that'll help. Just what happens next?
Yeah, I've started listening to you, I've been more and more inclined to go back to this project.
Awesome,
that I have.
Awesome, awesome. Well, you see, it's something to think about it. You know, and it's certainly, I'm not one of those folks who evangelizes for, do it, damn it. I mean, no. I mean, like, the harder you push someone who isn't ready to do something, the harder they're going to push back. So I'm real, I'm real diplomatic about encouraging writing. I never say do it. I say, look, it's something to think about. And the fact that here's the flattering thing is that you're not the first person who's told me that my writing and my podcast has inspired them to, start thinking about, telling stories again in prose or whatever. And I mean, that just blows me away. And it's kind of hard to wrap your brain around the fact when someone says, you're inspiring me. I mean, that's the ultimate compliment. That's worth $1,000. That's worth $1,000 because that means that the work is kind of hitting someone in a way that is invaluable and is intangible and motivating them. And that's beyond price. And so I'm really, yeah, I'm amazed to hear that. And all I can say is that, hey, look, I mean, what do you have to lose? I mean, it's not like you have to show anybody what you're writing, and it's not like you have to print it out and, give it to the Library of Congress. Nothing like that at all. It's just, just something to noodle on and think about. And like I said, I mean, the whole concept for people who are stuck, and I know this from experience, the comment, the mantra, what happens next became so important to me because in the end, Barry, I knew what was going to happen next. I began to see what I knew in my heart of hearts what was going to happen next, but I didn't have the foresight to be able to express it tangibly. And so that's why it became so helpful for me.
Yeah, I think I'll start using that now from this point forward. Once I get back into writing it.
Well, sure. I have to give credit where credit is due. I mean, the idea of what happens next, those words literally came from a New York Times bestselling novelist named Brad Meltzer, who writes, I think he's a brilliant writer, and he writes fantastic legal and political thrillers. And I have the good fortune of knowing him quasi personally. I mean, like, we've spoken, met through, professional friends or whatever. And and I remember going to a book signing of his and kind of laying it out, much like you, Barry, where it's like, I'm in the second act. I think I know where all this is going to end, but I'm stuck. And that's when he turned to me and said, you know the answer to this question in your heart, but you have to keep asking it, what happens next. And as soon as I heard that, it became clear, and it changed my life, and it changed my work ethic.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing how just something so small can change everything.
And seemingly underwhelming, because the words, what happens next, that doesn't sound very profound.
No, it doesn't, but yet at the same time.
But yeah, give it a shot. Let's see. I mean, it's free advice. I mean, you see what you can do with it.
Yeah, I mean, there's always that little quirky thing that just gets you moving. Mm-hmm. And I did want to kind of ask you this one. Is when you sit down to record, are there any quirky things you do? I mean, like Scott Sigler, I mean, we've mentioned him before, he goes into his closet.
Right.
And, I mean, I'm sitting in a basement for crying out loud with the washing machine and the heater right behind me.
Right.
And my computer open. I mean, I can look into my computer because it overheats otherwise.
Right.
But, and then I always have to sit at like the edge of my chair, otherwise it squeaks.
Yes.
And there's all these little quirky things
little
I
rituals.
Have to do before I start. Yeah. What do you have to do?
Well, let's see. I record in a spare bedroom here in our apartment, and it's kind of like our I'm not going to say library because that makes it sound like it's a really impressive collection of books. It's not. It's just, a couple of $30 bookshelves stocked with, paperbacks and thrillers and whatnot. comic books in my case, and that's really it. So it's pretty a fairly innocuous surroundings, and before, like back in the day with book one, I would often, because I didn't know the characters, I didn't. The characters are much more part of my life now, and I'm much more – I find it much easier to get into vocal character with them when I perform for the podcast these days. It wasn't always like that. And so there was a ritual at one time where I would, you know, walk around the apartment and kind of rehearse these voices. And in particular, I remember inventing the voice for a corrupt oil baron named A.U. Rookman, who has this wonderful, just kind of like screw the world attitude and screw the world voice. And I remember waving my arms and running around the house, you know, trying to find his voice and finally nailing it, and then dashing into the room to record it. These days, I think because it's become a much more predictable routine for me. I am able to, you know, what are my rituals? Well, you know, I get a big tall mason glass of water, and that's one thing. And I swap out my comfy squeaky chair for the very uncomfortable metal folding chair that does not squeak. And I read my manuscript. I read the chapter that I'm gonna record. I read it once and then I just fire it up. And typically that's about it. But when we get to doing the character voices, and I'm really, really, despite the fact that I'm not an actor, I'm very proud that so many people have complimented me on my performance of the characters for Seventh Son, because they're all very different voices. When I get to a character dialogue for Jack, for instance, I will often have to kind of get into that character very quickly. And what I will do, I've assigned ritualistic phrases to say that aren't in the novel at all. They're just things that I say to kind of get me into character. Jack is the one that a voice that I often have trouble with. So I have to say, "I'm Jack. I'm curious." And as I say, "I'm curious," I raise my voice. And now I can talk like Jack. Oh, da 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 da. And you know, while there isn't a whole lot of difference, let's face it, between my voice of J.C. Hutchins and Jack's voice, there is enough so that you can kind of distinguish it. With Kilroy 2.0, who is he's an obese mad hacker. He demands a certain kind of attitude and a certain kind of presentation, and he's known for his chuckle. So what I'll do to get into character for Kilroy is I'll begin to chuckle, and then I can tremble my voice and shake my head back and forth to talk like Kilroy 2.0. And it requires that kind of leap into that spot in my mind. So now the kooky rituals are often kind of what I do during recording to get into character.
You've killed off several of the clones. I'm not going to say who, because you have to listen to the story.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. But yeah, one of the things that I wanted to make clear, and I think this is influenced by Joss Whedon's work. I mean, you know, Buffy, Angel, Firefly. Is that in his comic book work, is that no one is ever safe in his stories, and that, you know, when things are at their most serene, you better watch out, because that's when someone's going to get it. And I kind of carried that into Seventh Son, where I wanted to make sure that people knew by the middle of book two that you can't count on anybody surviving.
But then again, you also can't expect anyone to actually die.
To be dead, because of the technology that's in the book, right? Where, you know, our villain in particular has been misusing technology that allows him to be able to record his consciousness, the entirety of his human memories, and to dump them into victims' minds so that he can actually live on in another body in a way and control that body with his psyche downloaded in the mind. So you know, that's one of the big problems that the clones faced in book two for such wonderful reasons. I mean, it's like one of my favorite plot twists of all is in book two. But particularly, you know, that's a problem they're going to have to solve in book three, where it's like, if you cannot identify the villain in any kind of obvious way, how do you take him down when he can be anyone or anywhere? And so, right, you know, there's this idea of nobody's safe, but the villain may not. You could stomp on the cockroach and here comes another one. You know, it's like how many of him is out there? And that's something that we'll learn in book three.
Oh, that, well, that's good to know that that's coming up, because I've been wondering that myself.
Yeah, well, it's kind of hard to keep track. I mean, it's like we have enough scenes in books one and two with the villains kind of doing the machinations of the villains, where they're, you know, they're twirling their mustaches and they're, you know, speaking, you know, they're sharing their plan, but they're not revealing everything to the listener. It's, those scenes were so hard to write because, you know, it's like, how can I give hints without blowing the plot twists? And we've gleaned enough information to know that there seems to be a small number of copies of the villain and a small number of copies of the assassin thug sidekick named Devlin. But not everybody's accounted for. So there's still some tricks up my sleeve for that.
Yeah, you've let out just enough that everyone I know that I've talked to and gotten to listen, they're all kind of sitting there going, okay, what the heck is going on? Why is this character in there? And I'm like, I don't know.
Right.
But it's three books.
We got to wait. We got, you know, and it's my sincerest hope that everybody enjoys the ending. Otherwise, I mean, it'll be like the biggest con in podcasting. unintentional con. I swear. I guess I'm just a lousy writer. But what's, you know, and Barry, you mentioned something that really kind of tickles me, and is that, you know, we've all got favorite bands. You know, a favorite band of mine is They Might Be Giants. And I love this band, and they rock my world. And despite the fact that I can tell them that they rock my world and that their music means so much to me, the music that they release, they have a different perception of it because they are the creators of it.
Right.
And that they would probably feel uncomfortable or might be, you know, surprised to hear people like me and my friends who are also geeks of that music talk about it and discuss the, like, what does this lyric mean? They're talking about cows under the sea. What's that all about? You know, and just kind of trying to do that stuff. And so I'm always so kind of blown away by the fact that when people say, well, I was talking to my friends about Seventh Son the other day and we were really stumped, because I'm like, what, you guys talk about it? Like, that's crazy. What do you mean? Because I'm not able to have that kind of experience with the work as an audience member. And mm-hmm. and so when you say thing, when you said that, that really kind of made me grin, because really, it's like, whether the book gets into print or not, and whether or not the thing becomes, you know, something that can be commercial, you know, can be an avenue, a revenue generator for me, it doesn't matter, because in the end, people are talking about it, and that. You know, the fact that people are moved enough to discuss it with their friends and ask questions like that, that's the thing that I find most rewarding.
Yeah, it's been one, as soon as I've handed off a disc and I've said, here's the first chapter, you'll love it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anyone's hooked. Everyone, and I'm going through, I bought about a year and a half ago, just from like my archives, I bought 100 discs, mm-hmm. just blank CDs. I'm almost through them.
Oh, my God.
I think I've used 15 for my archives for, like, pictures and documents and the boring stuff.
Well, pictures are not boring, but okay.
Well, the stuff everybody else is doing.
Oh, okay, I see. Okay. Predictable. Okay, right.
It's not something I'm just going and handing out.
Right, yes.
But I've gone through and burned enough that I think I'm down to, like, 10 to 15 discs
left. The rest
left.
Has been Seventh Son?
The rest has been Seventh
Holy
Son and a couple others, when I know that they're not sci-fi.
Yeah.
But it was
yeah.
Seventh Son that gave me the idea.
Oh, my God. That's amazing. That's amazing. Well, weren't you? Yeah, you were stuffing stockings, weren't you?
Yeah, I was doing it as Christmas presents.
Presents, right. Awesome. Well, you know, hey, look, I'm happy to help keep people's holiday expenses down by providing free content.
It was the best Christmas present, and everyone kept saying, so this is like the first one that's free, and then you have to pay for the rest.
No,
I'm like,
right?
No,
there's no scheme, there's no scam. I swear. That's awesome. Thank you for doing that. Thank you for telling me about that.
It's been my pleasure. The only caveat I told him is you might want to get a cardiologist.
Well, you know, it's so, again, it's like, you know, I'm blushing over here, because I mean, all I can keep saying is thank you, because I keep coming back to the fact that, you know, this is the podcast does generate money for me, in that at patiobooks.com, there's a system set up to, and my podcast is also at patiobooks.com. There's mm-hmm. a system set up where people can donate money, and, you know, 75% of it goes to the author, and the other 25% goes to maintain the website at patiobooks.com. But the kind of money that I receive there is minimal and is nowhere and never. You could never pay your rent. You could never buy groceries for a week with this kind of money. You know what I mean? Excluding the beer and pizza money that I occasionally get from PatioBooks.com, I'm not making any money off of this, and I actively tell people not to send me money, and I actively tell my guys over at GeekLabel.com, don't send me money. I don't want a cut of the profits for those Seventh Son shirts that you guys so brilliantly make. I just want to be kind of free and clear in the karma department and have everyone just kind of enjoying this for as low cost or as no cost as possible with the quiet prayer that people will remember me and remember the podcast and their experience and their entertainment if the book ever gets into print and they could buy a copy then.
Oh, I'll be buying multiple copies.
Me too.
I'll go, this is why I had that heart attack, kids. Yeah. It all started back here.
Back in the day. Now Dr. Kleinman's here. Well, hello, Barry. My goodness.
Oh, my God. We are getting the whole crew from Seven Sun.
What would you like to talk about?
Well, let's see. If
Barry, Earth this is Orlando invaded. Hill. You are not authorized to speak to Dr. Kleinman.
I'm sorry, General.
Okay. All right, I'm shutting up. I'm getting slap happy. I'm sorry. Okay. Please commence. I'm back.
Okay. Wow. You can really jump through those characters now.
Well, they've been with me for about a year and a half, yeah. And it always helps when, you know, I'll occasionally get a request from a podcaster to, you know, can you do a bumper for my show, a promotion for my show in a particular character voice, so that helps too. It's just fun to kind of go into that. A year ago, I would have been very self-conscious to do that or to even channel the character so quickly. It's been a long year and I've become really fond of the characters and actually performing them. So it's always fun to kind of freak people out and do something like that.
Well, I think the question I was going to here a little bit ago before we got so brilliantly sidetracked.
Sorry, dude.
Is when J.R. Tolkien, or is it? Yeah, J.R. Tolkien.
J.R.R. Tolkien. Yeah.
Yeah, J.R.R. Is that Harry Potter's author?
No, that's the author of the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Lord of the Rings.
And then there's J.K. Rowling, who wrote the Harry Potter series.
Yeah, when J.K. Rowling killed off one of her major characters.
Yes.
She said it was extremely hard for her to do.
Yes.
She did that a couple books ago.
Yes.
Did you have that same emotion with when you've killed off a couple of your characters or anyone in particular?
Yes.
Don't name it. But.
No, I won't. Yeah, I certainly did. One of the things that I've always been, before I wrote Seventh Son and before I started thinking about writing fiction, there was this whole, I would listen to or watch interviews or read interviews with authors who would say that the characters that they had created had become so real to them in their minds that not only would the character surprise them by saying dialogue in the novel that they had not anticipated, but doing things in the novel that they had not anticipated. And that always kind of, you know, I was always very skeptical about that. Well, it's true. It does happen where the character just doesn't want to play with your nicely written what happens next plot, you know, and they want to say what they want to do and do what they want to do. It's like I keep coming back to the word spooky because it is. But they also become very real it's my hope that the characters are real for the reader and that they are certainly even more real for me. And when we've lost some heroes along the way, and each death has been very traumatic for different reasons. One of the deaths was just so unexpected, and kind of started, it planted the idea that anybody could die. You know, the first guy to go, that was traumatic because I knew that, I liked that character a lot. He was my favorite character up until that point in the story. And that's why I killed him, is because, you know, he had to go because the other clones had to, get they needed to step up. They needed to become men and leaders on their own. And it was very traumatic for me. The other two deaths that have happened are very shocking and very very sudden. And I felt more for one than I did for the other. But ultimately, they're like losing a friend. There is another clone who isn't going to make it. All right. This is exclusive. I mean, I haven't told anybody this, and I probably won't tell anybody this. But there's another clone that isn't going to make it in book three.
It's going to be my favorite.
And I cried. I wept. I'm thinking about it right now, and I know it sounds so ridiculous for me to get misty-eyed about it as I speak about it right now, but I wept like a child writing his death. And you know, it's like you lost a friend. I mean, I remember kind of stepping away from the computer and saying, I've lost a friend. And it was traumatic. But again, you know, I knew that in the end it made the story better, and it made the arc better. And ultimately, I knew that it would move readers. And that's what you got to do. You not only do you keep moving the plot, but you have to keep moving the reader in an emotional way or an intellectual way, or else they'll tune out. Because once it becomes predictable, and once it becomes something that's pedestrian to do, and you start to see the things happening before they happen, then I've lost you. Then it becomes an exercise of trying to find out which guy, in the horror movie, which guy's going to die first, which guy's going to die next. And that's not what I wanted with Seventh Son. I tried to keep things as fleet-footed and as mysterious and as thrilling as I could.
Yeah, I haven't been able to find a formula that you've had. I mean, usually, like in horror films and everything, there's the, okay, if you have sex anytime in the movie, one of those two are going to die.
Right, yeah. You never say, I'll be right back, because you'll never be right back.
And if it's a virgin, having sex for the first time, she's dead.
She's totally
just
dead.
Toast, yeah.
Right. But of course, there will be a virgin who does not have sex, and she will be the victor in the end.
Absolutely. I mean, there's too many formulas out there that everybody knows, and you have done brilliantly on not putting anyone into a situation like that.
Well, thank you. One of the things that I wanted to do was, kind of immerse. I wanted to immerse the reader into a very believable 2007. You know, a very real. I didn't want it to take place in the near future. I didn't want it to take place in the far future, where human cloning will undoubtedly. I mean, we are going to be doing that. We are going to be doing that probably sooner than anyone would ever like us to. But I wanted it to be kind of a surprise. I wanted it to be taking place in a world in which we could all kind of understand and identify with. And I wanted to start off these kind of plot twists with something that appeared to be conventional, but then becomes something, takes a sidestep and kind of surprises you. And so I've always been very conscious when I was writing Seventh Son. I was very conscious of conventions and what I'd seen in movies countless times, and how to kind of sidestep that and maybe set up expectations to present that as a possibility for the reader, where the reader says, oh, I know what's going to happen next. And then boom, wait a minute. That wasn't supposed to happen. That's what I was trying to, that's what I was trying to do with Seventh Son as I was writing it.
Yeah. You got me on several of those too. Early on, I'm like, oh, this is going to happen. Blah, blah. What?
Oh, awesome.
I kept saying that more and more when I'm either driving to work or driving home, and I'm like, what? No. The formula says this.
Yeah, right. And you got to pay homage to the formula, and you got to understand that the formula works because it's well conceived, it's well tread territory. But being able to kind of tweak it here and there and melt the minds of the reader along the way. I mean, that's what defy. The whole point was to defy convention, write something that was intellectually and emotionally accessible, but was also kind of far out and messed with the tradition and messed with the conventions in a way that would be surprising to the reader.
Okay. Well, let's see. I have a question. I have a feeling you won't answer, but what's the name of book three?
No. As soon as I hear, I've done enough of these interviews, these pre-book three interviews, to know that when I hear the words, now I have a question, and I don't think you're going to answer. I mean, it's like you know, we go to DEFCON 1 over here. They're going to ask about the title of the book. They're going to ask about – no, I would love to tell you the title of the book. I'm not going to tell you the title of the book. Why am I not going to tell you the title of the book? Well, ultimately, it was what's really kind of funny is that, you know, I gave up the title of book two. I gave that out very early on in book one, where it was like someone called on the clone line and asked me, what's the title for book two going to be? And so I announced it there. And what was great was that when book two started coming to a close, there was more of this, where it's like, what's the name? What's the title going to be? He told us before. He'll tell us now. What's the title going to be? and of course, you know, it's like, let's face it. I mean, I just spent 5 minutes talking about how we defy the conventions, right? So I said, so it's like, you know, a precedent was set in book one, but that doesn't mean I'm going to stick to it, you know. And so now it's just withholding the information because people are just so into the idea of trying to decipher what the name is. And the thing, what I love about this, Barry, is that by the end, but when I announce the title of book three in the very first episode of book three, mm-hmm. everyone's going to be like, oh, geez, well, what was the fuss all about? We know what I could have told you that. I mean, there's nothing there, you know, it's not like some like vocab word that nobody knows, or, you know, some secret language. You know, people are going to hear it. They're going to be totally underwhelmed. But who cares? You know, I sat on it because people wanted to know, and I'm all about the cliffhanger. So. And there are a couple of things that people will then ask me. Well, what's the title of the book? Well, I can't tell you that. Well, is it going to begin with like the DE, like descent was, and deceit? Is it going to be deception? Or I can't even confirm that it's going to be with a DE. And then they follow up with, well, is the title of the book going to begin with a D, the letter D? And I can't confirm that either. No hints, people.
I think the favorite one from your final feedback episode that you did was Duh End.
Duh End, yeah. I had to do that.
That one, I just started laughing.
I know, like, it was so creative. That's brilliant. You know, that's the thing that kills me. It's like, you know, people, J.C. Hutchins, you're so creative. You wrote such a great book. It's like, dude, you know, you came up with Duh End. That is the funniest thing I've ever heard. Yeah, I mean, it's like I am surrounded. I've got, you know, more than 20,000 of my closest friends are all so freaking creative and so generous and giving, and I absolutely love them. I love them all.
Okay, well, one more question, and I'll let you get going here. You're coming out with book three on 7/7/07.
Yep,
which is purely ironic since it's seventh son, seven clones, blah blah blah.
Three books. Yeah, I know. It was a perfect marketing opportunity. I couldn't pass it up.
Was it a coincidence, or did you, as soon as you saw it, did you try to backtrack everything?
Totally, totally deliberate on my part. Where you know, there's, as with a lot of these things, at least in my life, in my creative life, and when it comes to marketing my book or whatever, there's often like a happy, if not a happy circumstance or coincidence, then situations that kind of make me think about things. And so, you know, I knew that book two was coming to an end. I knew that I was going to take another hiatus. And then it was like, okay, well, let me just count off the calendar days, you know, 90 days, 3 months until the next, you know, and then I'll just debut it then. And I'm thinking about it. It's like, and believe me, Barry, for the past 5 years, the number seven has been on my mind. Like, you would not believe. I see sevens everywhere. It's ridiculous. You know, Roman numeral seven. There's a seven on a car, la, la, la. And then, of course, you know, I start knocking towards July, and I pass June, and I'm like, oh, I remember that whole 6606 thing that I did with Scott last year, and wasn't that cool? And then it was like, boom, boom. Oh, wait a minute. So, you know, in this case, it was a happy set of circumstances got me thinking about how to market and when to announce Seventh Son Book 3. And then, of course, you know, and that dovetailed nicely into this brilliant, one-of-a-kind
thank you, dear Lord, for letting me be born in this millennium, you know, to be alive in this millennium kind of thing, where you know, I look at the calendar and there it is, you know, three books of Seventh Son, and then three sevens on the calendar, 070707. I was like, I just have to do it. I will do everything I can to make sure that the book comes out on that day. So, you know, unless like a cartoon piano falls on my head, I'm good to go for 7707.
Well, just remember, don't walk under any major buildings that are pulling things up at the time. Please.
That's right. Well, if I do get hit with a cartoon piano, my favorite part of all of this is I'm going to be, you know, not only is a great big lump going to appear on my head, but then I'm going to smile, and there's going to be, like, the piano keys inside my mouth. Bling, 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 bling.
Oh, boy. Yeah, stay away from trucks named Acme.
I will.
And again, let me thank JC for sitting down and talking with me. I mean, this is the interview part. There was stuff before. There was stuff after. It was just a lot of fun. Also, I did use the same intro, if you didn't notice, for this episode as I did on episode 71. So, hey, that's a little bit kind of tie in there. And remember, please go listen to Seventh Son. And also to really to all the books, all three books. And remember, 7707 is when the book finally drops. We've been waiting so long. Now we have it. So, hey, yeah, go check it out. And remember, this is a web-only thing, so yada, yada, yada. Also, just remember, please try to send me off to PME. Please, please. I'm really trying to get there. And life got in the way, and there went all those funds, which would have gotten me out there without me having to beg and plead. So, and also, if you make a donation of $25, I will send you stuff, too. I will send you a nice CD with a kind of a thank you from me to you. And it will also include every episode of Barely Podcasting, as well as all episodes from Chat Buffet, which was my other show, which is now defunct. So it's really kind of a cool way that you could get kind of the whole thing. Cool, huh? Anyway, yeah, here's all the contact information. I do have a show coming up next week. I hope you'll like it. It's a little bit out of the ordinary for me. And as I'm recording this, I've already recorded and done that. That one's done. I know, I'm evil. Anyway, here's the contact information, folks. You could visit the website at barelypodcasting.com. You could send me an email at barely@barelypodcasting.com. You could send me a Skype message at barely. Of course. What else would I be? Also, you can look me up on Twitter. And my name there is Barely. Of course. What else would it be again? You can also leave me a voicemail, which so many people do. It makes me feel like I'm loved. And that number is area code 206-984-3675, which also spells out dork. Hey, that's me, isn't it? And also, the music on today's show is all provided by the PodSafe Music Network over at music.podshow.com. And the intro and extra music that is part of every show now, which was so graciously provided by some of you, the fans of the show. That song is Happy by Jamie Brancher. And he is also over at the PodSafe Music Network. So yeah, go definitely check him out. And I think that is going to be it. How the hell can I do any work with this? Two last things before I go, folks. First of all, remember, if you need to update your domain names or you want a domain name, go over to GoDaddy.com. And use the code word blue, BLU15. If you need your web domain and you want to host on GoDaddy, use the code word pod15, POD15. That will also get, both of them will get you a 10% discount at checkout. So, hey, that's cool. You'll appreciate it. And I know GoDaddy will as well. Also, this show can be found on some of the best directories out there, including iTunes, Podcast Pickle, and Blueberry.com. So, yes, go check them out. And I think that is it. I will see you all next week, folks.